Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Colin, thank you so much for joining as we start our deep dive into the Little Tech Agenda.
Kevin, thanks for having me. And congratulations to you guys and everyone at FedSoft for building this platform. It's wonderful.
Yeah, thank you. It's a great opportunity to explore some of the most important regulatory questions and top of everyone's mind during what I like to call AI summer. And I guess other folks can call blockchain summer or biotech summer.
There's a bunch of them.
Lots of summer, tech summer.
Yep.
No better time to explore the Little Tech Agenda, and no better person, arguably, with the exception of maybe two or three others, to dive into what the heck the Little Tech Agenda is. So why don't we start there with just defining Little Tech? I'm sure a lot of folks probably have some definition, but let's go straight to Webster's in this case.
And I think there's a lot of people who have, you know, very big windups about what Little Tech is. I mean, I think we try and keep it fairly simple, right? Which is it's startups and entrepreneurs, and specifically startups and entrepreneurs having a policy and political voice now. I think it's sort of, to me, it kind of crystallizes around the bottom-up innovation, which I think we've seen grow in the United States significantly over the last 50 years, but really in the last 25 to 30. I think fairly simple, startups and entrepreneurs.
Right. And with that in mind, simple, clarity, easy breezy, what's the agenda itself? So, you know, we have this definition of expansive scope of entrepreneurs and innovators.
Yep.
What's the agenda? What are the core policy planks that you think folks should know about?
Yeah, I mean, look, from a top line perspective, I think it is, how do we advance and ensure that the builders in the little tech space, and we're talking about, you know, teams of 5 to 50, most of them starting garage or a Palo Alto studio or, you know, a New York apartment, or, you know, I Steve Case would certainly say the rise of the rest. Maybe
we gotta say an Austin bungalow.
Austin, Texas, gotta include something there.
Yeah.
Exactly, right? How are we allowing them to build in the way that I think that will not only allow them to build incredible products, but also ensure that America is at the forefront of innovation, which we have been over the last 50 years. That's, I think, the very, very core component of all this.
And when we look at something like the American Innovators Network, which has been labeled as a sort of policy hub for the Little Tech Agenda, there's at least a 9, if not a dozen, core policy ideas ranging from workforce development to access to capital to talent pipelines. Mm-hmm. Are there any of those policy provisions that you think are particularly important or that you really want to highlight and accentuate as key to the agenda?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there's a couple of them, right? One, I think a common thread that you see across all of them is permissibility of open source. Mm-hmm. We talk about it. I mean, it was bullet number 2 in the AI action plan. I'm sure we'll get to that at some point. It is sort of the core function, the core thesis around blockchain technology, these open decentralized networks. I think that even if you look at some of the things, even the defense procurement space, I mean, the ability to have sort of these open systems where people can build on top of, I think is really, really important. And we can get into sort of why that has been such a top policy priority, because it has been basically an afterthought. Everyone was able to build sort of these open source technologies forever and ever and ever, and has been a sort of a core backbone of all of this innovation in the United States. I think what actually differentiates as compared to the world. And then I think, you know, the other piece of this, like you touched on, like workforce development, I think is incredibly important, but it's also like, where does, there's a bunch of sort of subcategories of all of this, which sort of suggests of like, what if you allow builders to build in a specific area in these hubs, right? What does that mean for the greater ecosystem of that space? Mm. What does that mean for the American people? And I think that actually I think is probably the most important thing. So when you talk about sort of these policy threads, certainly in AI, there's open source. There's, you know, we talk about sort of 50 state national patchwork. From a crypto perspective, I think it's much more focused on the federal government, which is how do we find market structure? How do we find market structure legislation? How do we get there? We just passed a stablecoin bill. We can talk about that some too. From a defense procurement perspective, I think the top line is, you know, there's a lot of past performance issues. It's how do we unlock some of these things? How do we allow startups to enter the space where we have all these primes? There's a whole bunch of stuff in the bio and health space that, you know, that I think is really important. So I think each of these different categories has kind of their own sort of bespoke issues in a way. But the common thread is how do we let builders build in clear regulatory frameworks? And how do we make sure that some of the innovations and some of the ideas that we've had all the way back to the 96 Telecom Act persist through time?
Mm-hmm. And from the outset, I think it's important that I disclose I'm very sympathetic to this building mentality and supporting startups and making sure that we continue to be a nation of disruption and a nation in which the foundational elements of innovation are broadly available.
Right.
Because to your point, if you think about Linux, if you think about all these open source technologies that have enabled the folks in the garage, the folks in the bungalow to try their hand at some crazy new idea, that is the American way. And I don't know of any other thing besides maybe apple pie and baseball that's more American to saying we want folks to build things and try things and experiment. But why do we need a little tech agenda? And I want to get to the origin story here, where we'll hear later in this series that this is just window dressing, that the little tech agenda is just lipstick on a pig that says, you know, we're not calling them startups anymore because, you know, maybe that's tainted. Their Theranos, it doesn't look too good. Or we have Sam Bankman-Fried doesn't have positive vibes right now. So this is just an attempt to trick the public into thinking we need some new fun way of supporting what ends up being the pockets of investors and VCs.
Yeah. I mean, look, every great idea has haters, right? Look, I think in order to be able to tell the full story, we need to probably go all the way back to the founding of the internet.
I was about to think you were going all the way back to the founding of the country. And it's like, Colin, the country. I don't know if we have that here? Much time. I'm
yeah,
so sorry.
Where's this pod heading?
Okay, just the internet.
Just the internet. Yeah. So you know, look, I think there's been, I'm certainly not the first person to come on a podcast and talk about the cycles and the stages of the internet, right? I mean, you know, Web3 is this, you know, crystallized term that I think has existed largely in the crypto space, but I think it actually encapsulates much, much more of sort of like what is actually going to be the next sort of wave of connectivity and internet. And what are people going to build in that space? And we can get to that in a second. But, you know, look, like as a firm, you know, and this is really sort of, you know, Mark and Ben's ideology here, which is, you know, we're more in the talent business than anything else. And where we find is the talent goes and it attracts to sort of the next big thing that's coming. Mm-hmm. What I think most people miss is the next big thing that is coming actually happens in sort of these clusters of different technologies, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I think it's very easy to say right now that AI is coming and it's going to be all AI. I think we see things a little bit different, but let me take you back to sort of, you know, the 90s, which was really sort of the advent of email and the web browser coming online at the same time that allowed people to go online. They could read the news. They could, you know, they could find information that traditionally would only be in print, but they could also interact with their friends and their family and things like that. And then, you know, obviously that turned into AIM, and we can all, you know, talk about our embarrassing screen names and things like that. But
let's not.
Yeah. Maybe we shouldn't. But then that sort of morphed into the rise of, we had social networking come online. Facebook, you know, launched in, I think, 2004, formally, to, you know, the general public, maybe outside the Ivies, to all of us who knew weren't at an Ivy.
Yeah, exactly.
We had the advent of the iPhone. We had, you know, the application layer that was built, cloud compute from a storage perspective. You didn't have to host everything locally. And that has really carried us over the last, you know, 15 years. I think we're still sort of somewhat in that space. We're obviously using classic applications on iPhone, and that's a big part of the way we interact. Uber is a perfect example of that. What I think what we see and where we see all the talent going is into, you know, I think three different categories, which is AI, of course. You know, crypto blockchain has been a, you know, a stalwart in the space, although it has taken, you know, a huge hit based on the regulatory environment and also things like FTX happening. There's no doubt that there are scams and things like that going on in the space. But I think the underlying technology is super, super important. And I think we will prove that it'll prove over time that, you know, it's very, very critical. And then I think the other part of this is sort of what we call the physical world category, which is, you know, we have a whole American dynamism platform that is designed to be traditional invest, more traditional investing into energy and defense tech and education items and infrastructure in the United States, more for, you know, the American dream, which is like what differentiates America from other places, which is, you know, the our ability to sort of actually build for the national good. Mm-hmm. So I think the reason I bring those up is because if you look at it, you're building the web browser. I think Mark would probably disagree with this, but you're building the web browser. You largely are able to build the web browser because of the 96 Telecom Act.
Right.
You know, email was a public-private partnership. Then it private, you know, we obviously build front ends that are private, Gmail on SMTP, and then, you know, you're able to communicate. When, you know, Mark Zuckerberg was building Facebook, it was, again, the 96 Telecom Act. And then, you know, Section 230, and I don't want to get into 230. I won't litigate it. You know, I mean, this is something for, you know, other people on your pod to discuss.
Another pod, right.
Another pod. But those protections allowed people to basically build these things within reasonable regulatory frameworks at the federal level and then comply with consumer protection and, and, you know, civil rights laws and privacy laws and things like that at the state level. But if you look at the next three categories of things that are coming, okay, crypto, blockchain, AI, and sort of this physical world category, I would say, I don't think that it's hyperbolic to say that all three are somewhat under siege or have been under siege. Mm-hmm. There is certainly a huge movement within the policymaker community to try and shape these technologies in a way that we believe would be counter to sort of what would actually remain, keep America and allow them to remain competitive and allow them be sort of the global technological force that it is today, right? So then how does this wrap back to little tech, right? All of these builders who are building these space, right, are trying to build. Most of them are five people in a studio apartment like we talked about before. If you're five people in a studio apartment and you have an incredibly onerous downstream liability standard from a California privacy bill or you have a or a California AI bill that says, oh, I created this open source model, now someone else built on top of it, you know, it ended up in the wrong hands and someone's using it for bad. And now you're in jail. I mean, that's a very serious departure from where we have been in technological innovation and policy for a very, very long time. So, you know, look, I think the big question is, okay, why does little tech need to enter? Like, why do you need the moniker of little tech? Why do you have to market as little tech? Well, the reason that I think a lot of these lawmakers are so upset at the general tech industry mm-hmm. is because of what has now been labeled as big tech, right? Some of the, you know, all of the, I'm sure the endless litigation that's gone on this pod and many other pods of what do we do about sort of the power of some of these major tech platforms and the consolidation of the internet has basically crystallize in some policymakers' minds mm-hmm. that, you know, we need to take this broad, paint this industry with a broad brush and bring down the hammer on everyone. And I think what we're trying to say is, in a lot of circumstances, what certainly what works for, you know, a $1 trillion platform isn't going to work for five people in a garage. Mm-hmm. That's part one. But the other piece is, if you're trying to build, you know, if you're trying to use AI to come up with some tool that allows you to do some innovative data mapping of a field for agriculture, that's a lot different than you running a social media network. And we should not treat everyone the same. So I think little tech was born out of this concept of there has to be something that can juxtapose some of the ideas that are coming from the big tech folks, not to mention that they can live with a lot more regulation than, you know, than a five person startup. So what they're advocating for in certain circumstances is often in opposition for what would actually be beneficial to making sure that these builders actually grow and sustain in a reasonable way.
Yeah, and something that I think is underappreciated about the little tech agenda itself is right. The storytelling element, where right. Some people will say, that's the worst part of, right. Oh, you know, maybe it's not grounded in every single empirical study that they've ever read in their entire lives, sure. or they can find a contradictory report. But as you were pointing out, startups need talent. And I think an underappreciated, now to turn to empirics, an underappreciated fact is that a growing share of the U.S. labor force is working for larger and larger firms.
Yeah.
That's how we access healthcare. Larger right. firms can afford to provide childcare. Larger firms have all of these added benefits that a small tinkerer might not be able to offer you. And yeah. so having people feel inspired about getting to build the future is actually something we need to insist on from a policy perspective and 100%. From an incentives perspective. But this does drive one question, which is, should the little tech agenda be understood as perhaps anti-big tech or just trying to distinguish itself from big tech?
I think it's more on distinguish, mm-hmm. right? Like, I think that there's definitely elements there where, you know, look, like most of the people who we fund are disruptors. Mm-hmm. These people who are trying to disrupt legacy industries. And if you go, like, I mean, going back to sort of the example of the three, right? You know, crypto blockchain in some ways, although I would argue strongly that it is much more than financial services, but think about it, right? Like this is sort of a challenge to the incumbency, which are mega banks. This is the challenge to the incumbency that exists in the traditional financial services space, but it's also a challenge to the incumbency sort of legacy tech platforms. And the same thing with AI, right? Like there are, you know, we're absolutely for a level playing field across the board. You know, the big should be able to live, the little should be able to live and be able to compete fairly. But I think the same sort of dynamic exists there. There are a bunch of sort of scrappy startups that are trying to unseat these, you know, these mega giants. And then, you know, the physical world space, there are these primes that have been put in place and held this legacy incumbent platform for years and years and years, and there's basically been no competition. Thankfully, now there are. Anduril's obviously coming on board and things like that. But I think that it's about how can the big and the small coexist mainly. But certainly, if the big are going to advocate for policies that disadvantage the little, then it will be an adversarial relationship, and they've got to be able to fight.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that healthy mix of big, little, medium, everything in between is really important because right. in some contexts, like in the AI space, we know we wouldn't have frontier models be in the US if we said, hey, the second you cap out at however many employees, we're just not going to support you anymore, or we're going to ban you or something like
that. Or flops thresholds, for instance. Right. I mean, look at the EU.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You need scale in some of these industries.
Sure.
And you need innovation that can build off of the scale and the open source, hopefully, that amounts from or that derives from those bigger companies. But I guess to go on the opposite side of the spectrum, mm-hmm. another critique could be, okay, great. A16Z, other VCs, they support
sure.
their portfolio companies.
Yeah,
obviously. Who wouldn't? They want to do well. What about the littlest little tech? The folks who aren't going to be receiving massive evaluations, who aren't going to be maybe partnering with an A16Z. How does this agenda help those folks who are just pursuing marginal multipliers on their original investment and kind of the littlest of the little guys?
Well, I think that's the beauty of like if you're advocating for policies that level the playing field, then that level is playing field for everyone, right? It doesn't matter. Look, if you're a two-person shop and you're not looking for venture dollars, but you really want to make, you want to make a couple hundred thousand dollars a year and run a reasonable business that supports, you know, bolts that then go to a ship or something like that, or, you know, whatever small part you want to play in your community. I think these policy sets should advantage those people just as much as they advantage the startups that are able to raise, you know, venture dollars from us.
Right. And
yeah.
Another critique that could be thrown at you all that I'm eager mm-hmm. to hear about. So we're leveling the playing field for everyone.
Sure.
Does that mean you would welcome regulation, let's say a privacy regulation that is tiered or structured to say, hey, the compliance burdens on this set of firms, these smaller set of firms, are still going to be raising the bar for privacy or raising the bar for consumer protection, but providing some degree of flexibility, and big tech may face more specifications, but we're okay with regulations so long as it's not resulting in an unfair playing field. Is that a fair take?
Yeah, 100%. And let me get into a couple different things. So first, it's a great question, and thank you for asking it. I mean, I think part of the criticism that we've heard, and I think you're kind of alluding to, is, oh, well, Little Tech doesn't want any regulation whatsoever. I think nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, if you look across, you know, just us specifically, right? We're a venture capital firm, but also the startups that we've invested in that, you know, we have strong relationship with, what they're actually advocating out on the field in a lot of cases is very pro-regulation, is very, hey, we want standards, we need things. Crypto, look no further than crypto, certainly, right? But I think the perfect example here is in the AI space, right? You're talking about sort of these tiered levels. Like, should we have all different standards for, like, once you hit certain thresholds, all of a sudden you kind of fall in a different regulatory bucket? I think the problem with that is the federal government, certainly, and a lot of times in the state government, it's really hard to draw arbitrary lines, mm-hmm. right? I mean, we've been dealing with this. I mean, like, let me give you an example, right? The Biden executive order came out with this theory of compute threshold, which is, you know, flops, like, you know, the floating point per, you know, average that, mm-hmm. that allowed people to sort of, like, it suggests that, okay, this is actually a very good compute standard.
Right. Kind if of like you the, hit this, you're the right. equivalent to horsepower of a car, right? If you, exactly. if you've got a Hummer, we're a little more scared of you, is the theory. If you're driving a Fiat, probably exactly. not a big deal.
Right. Exactly. So if you know, the theory being, okay, well, if you actually have above this compute, then it's a very powerful model and therefore you should fall in this different category. I think, you know, on its face, that makes a ton of sense. The problem is that you where we have seen this in other rules and regulations is what you effectively have done is two things. One, you have created a level by which you can create a regulatory moat, mm-hmm. right? So you can just continue to layer on and layer on and layer on regulation and also incentivize people to get into this higher threshold category. And once you're in there, you're boxed in, right? We've seen this like countless times. So that's one. And I think that disadvantages mm-hmm. Little Tech greatly. I think the other point here is, as we all know, the government is not good at updating their standards.
What?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. So it's kind of akin to, okay, well, you know, if you say that if you put together a law or regulation based on compute capacity of the iPhone 3 and say, all right, we're going to say everything over the iPhone 6 is going to have to fall in this different regulatory bucket. They're not going to go back and update that standard. Now, obviously, I mean, the standard came out, I think it was like 10 to the 25th flops. And, you know, I mean, I think there are some standards in different countries and things like that. But in a lot of cases, we've already reached that. They were like, oh, we won't reach it for years and years. And it's already been reached, right? I mean, it's the federal government doesn't really take into account Moore's law very well. Yeah. And I think that that's also a big fear, right? All of a sudden, something that was designed to only capture two or three companies is now capturing the entire ecosystem. And if you're, you know, it puts a really high regulatory burden when something was designed originally for a $1 trillion company and now is being burdens on, you know, 20 to a five person startup. So I think we would argue the right way to do this is sort of, don't put in sort of these standards, these thresholds based on sort of company size or revenue or things like that. Take a look at the entire space in AI, for instance, right? Rather than trying to put together some sort of licensing regime or a licensing regime light, regulate harmful use, mm-hmm. right? So if someone takes, it doesn't matter if it's the smallest of the small model or the biggest of the big model, if someone is using that for bad, if someone is trying to misuse the model or execute a spear phishing attack, or if they're trying to use this to create a bioweapon, all of that should be punishable by the law. They should aggressively prosecute those people versus trying to say, all right, well, all of a sudden we're going to put you into this different category and you're going to have this whole, you know, regulatory structure and yada, yada, yada.
It's so funny to me because a lot of what you're saying is just good policymaking. And the thing to me that is, to be blunt, very annoying is that folks aren't realizing if you're trying to regulate in a dynamic, complex space,
right,
then your laws should reflect that, right? To just say we're going to plant a flag and assume that nothing's going to change. And to your point, Congress isn't very good at revisiting laws. Right. Agencies, even with retrospective review, very rarely say, oh, even though we've seen that this regulation is horribly flawed,
right,
well, we'll just carry on, right? States also, we know, don't necessarily have that institutional capacity. But you pointed out a second ago, you know, we have the AI action plan was just released yesterday. We're talking in late July. We saw the stablecoin legislation get passed. Agenda solved. Everything's good. So, right? Can we just cross off the agenda? Things are going pretty swell for you all. Yeah. Do we still need this emphasis, or maybe it's time for to wrap it up, give it a retirement banner, put it up in the upper rungs?
Yeah, no, I mean, look, I it's wonderful to have some wins on the board, I will say. I mean, especially because, you know, look, we as a firm have been at this for 3 years, and we're now finally seeing sort of the fruits of our labor. But look, I think the way that we view this is long term. I mean, I think one of the beauties about working here is all of the bets we make are long term bets. You know, it's first class business with first class people. We make long term bets. We invest in the long run. We invest in relationships. And I think we look at, you know, each pod of area that we're actually involved in as sort of these networks that we have to foster and culture and things like that. So a lot of credit goes to Mark and Ben, but we view this sort of in perpetuity, mm-hmm. right? It's no longer the case that I think startups and entrepreneurs and the small so the small can just stick their heads in the sand and say, all right, well, you know, we're gonna hope for the best because we think that there are a bunch of reasonable people who think fondly of our industry. I think that that's exactly the opposite. And you know, the famous quote is, you know, you might not be interested in politics, but politics is interested in you. So I think we very much take that view. And I think that, you know, our hope is that we're around for the long term. You know, if for whatever reason, all of a sudden we hit some sort of homeostasis in some beautiful state and, you know, we change our American politics, then maybe, you know, there won't be roles for guys like me and you. But I unfortunately, I think it's only accelerating. Right. Mm-hmm. But look, like it, you know, back to your point, it is really nice to see some points on the board. I mean, the stablecoin, the Genius Act was an enormous, enormous victory. Fortunately, unfortunately, I was a staffer and I was on the Hill, I was actually put pen to paper on sort of like, I think the first draft. This was, you know, 5 years ago.
And the baby really, Genius Act.
The baby, well, yes, they did much better than I did. It was, you know, personally very, it was wonderful to see that actually come to fruition and maybe able to go to a bill signing ceremony. So that was big. Now, you know, I will say there's still plenty of work to be done on the crypto side. Obviously, the market structure bill, which is the Clarity Act that came out of the House that has, you know, huge bipartisan support, is really the thing that will kind of unlock the large part of the industry to sort of really, really have that sort of network effect in the crypto space. It also give the rules of road for, you know, exchanges. How do they federally register? How do we launch tokens effectively outside of the stablecoin space? So I think that that's really super important. So we're actively engaging on that along with, you know, our whole portfolio in the crypto space.
And so I'm sure there's a couple of listeners who are thinking, all right, yeah, I read Mark and Ben's post back in 2024 about the Little Tech Agenda.
Yep.
Now there's a whole RTP series about it. Fascinating. Who else is supporting this? Who else is behind it? Who else is championing it? Who are your supporters that you can point to and say, you know, this movement is going to have legs because this R and this D and this civic group, they're all behind it. How is this movement kind of going from your vantage point?
Yeah, well, I mean, unfortunately, the movement started because of just absolute and existential risk, I will say. You know, and I have a lot of, not to keep going back to crypto, but I think crypto was really kind of the tip of the spear, right? You know, I mean, it was a whole technological class that was just under siege from, you know, regulators. And I think people were totally caught off guard. Thankfully, I think that taught everyone a lesson, which is you can't, again, stick your head in the sand. You've got to be able to go out there and fight. The problem, though, is like a lot of times you graduate from, you know, a highly technical university, you're building, and you haven't ever even considered the fact that you might have a regulator knocking at your door, you know, and God forbid, you know, you do something incorrect and you know, you have this, you know, civil penalty or, you know, criminal penalty at your doorstep. So I think a lot of this has been, you know, a barrier break with the crypto industry and their push and people seeing what they went through, you know, and some of it was justified. I'm not here to sort of defend everything that's going on in crypto, but a lot of it was just, you know, pure lawfare. And now what happened with SB 1047 in California was a real wake up call to a lot of very, very small entrepreneurs. So to answer your question bluntly, I think that it is really driven by sort of this grassroots ecosystem of these startups and entrepreneurs. We have the benefit and, you know, the fortunate responsibility of also being say, well, look, we're also a scaled institution. In a lot of circumstances, we've got more resources and we can put those forth. So a lot of what we do is education downstream to the portfolio companies. Like, here's what's happening. Here's what's going through. We need you to activate. I know that even if you can give, you know, 10 minutes of your time a month, that makes a difference. You know, we want you to be able to build full time, but you've got to be able to, you know, scratch out a little bit of time. And I would say, like, there are other venture firms. Like, I think YC is also a great partner in all of this. I mean, they are all always holding and, you know, carrying the little tech flag. And you know, look, I think the other thing here is, like, I think it has sort of matriculated into policymakers, right? I think there are a lot of policymakers now who say, okay, look, this actually makes a lot of sense. You know, I have problems. I personally have problems with big tech. I don't agree with everything that's going on, but I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater on tech. I want to support the little tech people, the people who are trying to build and really build, you know, reasonable products, because I think that that's the future of America. I mean, keep in mind, right? The number one driver of job growth in the United States is tech, right? Now, obviously, a lot of that, you know, the hiring is happening in the big tech space, but there's still a lot of hiring that goes on in all of these tech companies. It is the one thing that we're able to sort of have, you know, a five-person startup 1 year, and 2 years later, they're hiring tens of thousands of people. I think the other thing here is, like, the tech industry is carrying the stock market and has been carrying the S&P 500. I saw an incredible stat that basically suggested that most of the, outside of the Magnificent Seven, the rest of the S&P has basically been flat or up 1% over the last 30 years.
Right.
It's really amazing. So and you know, like, the most important piece of that is our national security. It is also our number one national security tool. It is our number one deterrent to China and authoritarian regimes. And I think that what makes us super dynamic.
Yeah. So. Well, and to add to that, it would be the economic security factor that I don't think gets discussed enough in terms of when we see contraction among Fortune 500 companies or even among big tech, as we're seeing now. I mean, Microsoft laying off 9,000 folks recently, and we see headlines like that seemingly every day. The startups are the ones who are creating the next wave of bigger tech companies or new companies to begin with of any category. And they're the ones who can buoy the economy during these tough economic doldrums or even downturns of saying, hey, if big tech isn't hiring, where are you going to go? Jobs just don't appear out of the ground. And we don't have a federal jobs guarantee or something like that.
Yeah.
The best guarantee, the best bet, is if we have that dynamic competitive market where a lot of folks can find new jobs, find new employment, only because new technologies are coming about.
Yeah.
And I just think that's a core component of it as well.
Totally agree with you, 100%.
So what is the biggest misconception that you want to tackle before we kind of wrap up your great perspective on the little tech agenda? What other concerns or maybe compelling counterarguments have you considered that you want to tackle head on right now?
Yeah, I want to go back to one thing. We already touched on this, but I think one of the biggest criticisms we've heard is just that little tech, A16Z, we don't want any regulation. I just want to underscore, nothing could be further from the truth. I think that in every single industry that has flourished, there has been reasonable, proactive regulation. Unfortunately, you know, the crypto space, it was not proactive, it was reactive. We lived under regulation by enforcement for a very long time. Now, with the stablecoin bill being passed, with a really, really strong effort, not only from the Trump administration, but also the House and the Senate, to lead on market structure legislation, I feel confident that we're going to get that done. So that's, you know, that's the crypto space. On the AI front, again, kind of going back to sort of, you know, the harmful use component of these things, you know, my colleagues who spend a lot of time really digging, my colleague Matt Peralp, for instance, really digs in on these issues, and he leads for us on how do we come up with a reasonable policy framework for little tech. And this is in conjunction with our little tech partners, the actual startups, talking to them, being on the field, what works, what doesn't work. There's a lot of really creative ideas, I think, in the AI space that are going to be necessary, and we're going to have to fill regulatory gaps. There's a whole bunch of ideas on the defense procurement side. There's a whole bunch of ideas in the energy side. I mean, there's a whole host of categories in which we are incredibly involved and incredibly pro-regulation. So I think that is the primary thing that I would love to get across to your listeners, which is, like, we need regulation. Regulation is super important. We, you know, obviously we're, you know, hugely supportive of the AI action plan that came out yesterday that is regulatory forward. So yeah, I think that's the number one takeaway.
Yeah. Well, we know you have a lot of startups to go advocate on behalf of and plenty of work to do during this so-called AI summer. So one final question, looking 5 years from now.
Yeah.
What are we going to be saying about the little tech agenda?
I think we'll be saying that the little tech agenda led to several landmark pieces of legislation at the federal level, several landmark pieces of legislation at the state level, in conjunction with very forward-thinking policymakers who are great on both sides of the aisle. And I think that they will hopefully say, if we have anything to do about it, that those form the groundwork for the next 25 years of innovation in the United States, and made sure, above all, that America leads and China does not.
Colin, you just gave yourself a heck of a lot of homework. Good luck with that. We will let you get to it. And thank you again for coming on the pod.
Thanks, Kevin. This is great. Thanks.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.